Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome Frederick Hertz. He is the author of the book, Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for including me.
It's interesting that gay marriage is really at the forefront of the gay liberation movement at this point, when, 30 years ago, there was a kind of political and cultural rejection of the norms of straight society. Now there's a movement to embrace those norms in the fight for gay marriage. What's going on?
Well, it's funny. I jokingly said at one point, I thought two of the added features of being gay is you could avoid marriage and the military, and obviously I was wrong on both counts. I think several things have happened. One is that between AIDS and babies, I guess you call it life and death or birth and death, a lot of people come to realize that being on the margins has its real problems. And as couples got accepted and gay people got accepted, people started to say, wow, you know, why can't I have a life like my parents, like my brother, like my sister? So the culture has changed in that way. The other is, frankly, the mainstream has changed. As I say a lot in the book, if marriage was as it existed 75 or even 50 years ago, I don't think that many gays or lesbians would want to have anything to do with it. But in fact, marriage has changed. So the community has changed and marriage has changed.
Let's step back for a moment. Gay men and women have been up against a lot of things historically. And as you say in the book, for gay men, the danger was being put in jail. And for women, it was losing custody of their children.
Absolutely. You know, I'm 57, and so I started going to gay rights events and things about 40 years ago. The first chapter of the book is sort of my personal history of the gay marriage movement. And, you know, I started going to gay lawyers' conferences 30 years ago. And, you know, they were very short. There wasn't a lot to talk about. And criminal arrest and child custody and some civil rights discrimination were the key issues. It has just totally changed in the last 15, 20 years. And it's a good change.
How does the historical ban on gay marriage compare to the old ban on interracial marriage? I think that's an interesting comparison.
Oh, it is. Well, first of all, there never was a federal disregard. So if you were married in, let's say, Massachusetts in an interracial marriage, the federal government still gave you all the benefits of marriage. Up until same-sex couples came along, we never had a federal ruling on what constituted marriage. Oh, I'm sorry. There was one about 150 years ago for bigamists and polygamists. So it's true that the polygamous marriages of Utah were not federally recognized. But the interracial marriages were recognized federally. The problem with interracial marriages was that they were banned in some states. And if you were married in Massachusetts and then you moved to Virginia, your marriage could thus be illegal. So they had an interstate non-recognition problem. Same-sex couples have both an interstate non-recognition problem and a federal non-recognition problem. And they both cause a lot of problems.
What happened to interracial marriage? I mean, when you're talking about, it was funny, I was thinking, if you're an attorney who's working on ecological policy, then you have science to work with. If you're an attorney who's working on highway and traffic policy or emissions and pollution.
Good point.
But if you're an attorney who's working on marriage, what you have is sex, emotion, tradition. I mean, it seems also so very subjective.
You also have a community who is very fed up with the current situation. The way interracial marriage worked, well, basically, there were very few couples who were affected by it because, frankly, the interracial couples that existed moved to states that welcomed them. They didn't stay that long in those unwelcome states. And right now, it's not really practical for every gay couple in America to move to one of 12 states. So there were fewer practical problems, as I understand it. It was more of a civil rights problem, not a practical problem. And also because there was federal recognition, you didn't have the tax problems that we have. Even so, it was about 25 years between the first state lifted the ban, which I think was California, and the U.S. Supreme Court finally lifted the ban on interracial marriages nationally 20 years later. And the other part that's interesting is the year that the Supreme Court lifted the ban on interracial marriages, public polling showed that the public was against interracial marriages, like 4-1. So one of the things that people always say is, hey, is it really fair that the Supreme Court step out of pace with the public? And in fact, that's what the court has been doing, rightfully so, for decades.
And that was very recently. I mean, that was within both of our lifetimes.
1967. So yeah. I don't know how old you are, but it's definitely within my lifetime.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the first same-sex couple to apply for a marriage license.
Well, this I'm very fond of because it's my home state. It was Jack Baker and Mike McConnell, who I must say are still together as a couple 40 years later. Jack Baker was quite famous because he was the student body president at the University of Minnesota, and then his partner was a librarian, and so they actually had public benefits at stake, and they applied for a license. They were rejected. Filed the case, went all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court, which I must say I also worked at one point during my legal career, not on this decision, though. And they were roundly rejected. And the part that is so hard for people to understand is people thought they were crazy. Gay people thought they were crazy. It was like the notion that gay people could get married was just, you know, just taken as just this insanity and was as unvalued or and source of suspicion for gay people as well as straight people.
And then came AIDS in the 1980s, and some very practical considerations came up, namely that the partners of people who were in the hospital or out of the hospital and dying suddenly weren't allowed to take care of their own beloved partners if the family didn't want them to.
Absolutely. And then there were problems upon death with inheritance. I helped set up the AIDS Legal Referral Panel, which was a free legal services to people with AIDS, starting in 1982 in San Francisco. And I was dealing with all sorts of situations where legal family, i.e. not the partner, were coming in after death and taking over the apartment, taking over possessions. There were even problems of who authorizes an autopsy. I had this terrible case situation where only the siblings could authorize the autopsy, and the partner wanted an autopsy. I've had cases where remains were wrongly disposed of. There were all sorts of problems. And then and even now in the non-recognition states, couples could deal with many of these problems by having powers of attorney, by having wills, by having contracts. But, in fact, most people don't do that. Straight or gay, most people don't think they're going to die anytime soon. They don't think they're going to be dumped by their partner. And so they don't do these agreements, and so where marriage or state-registered domestic partnership comes in is that it provides a safety net even if the couple hasn't done their own contractual agreements.
How much of a motivation for marriage rights is about access to health insurance, and if any, and what role does the current health care reform movement play in this whole set of questions?
Well, that's really interesting. I got a call today from somebody who was talking about wanting to state register so that they could get on their partner's health insurance. And I had to say, look, you're signing up for something that could cost you millions of dollars, who knows, between alimony, child support if there are kids, community property, debt liability. This is not something you should do just for the sake of health insurance. But given how expensive health care is, and given that individual policies are very hard to come by, and given that most employers do provide spousal or domestic partner coverage, I find it an amazingly powerful motivation. And in fact, when I ask people, as I always do, you know, well, you've been together for 10 years, why are you registering now? Or you've only been together 2 months, why are you registering now or marrying now? Overwhelmingly, they will say access to health insurance benefits. And to the extent that individuals can get their own policies, despite pre-existing conditions and at reasonable rates, I hope this will no longer be a motivation. Both because I don't want people to marry just for that reason. But also, we have to remember there are a lot of single people out there. My work is talking about the rights of couples, but frankly, the rights of single people to get benefits and insurance is just as important. So I hope that this will soon no longer be such a motivation, but it really is one now.
We're talking to Frederick Hertz, author of the book Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. I think you said somewhere in the book that there were people who were so excited when their state legalized same-sex marriage that they went out and got married. That can be a problem, too, if the whole set of rights and responsibilities and emotions associated with marriage are not taken into due consideration.
Yes. I want to put a plug in, and it's relevant to your question. I now have a new website called makingitlegal.net, not .com, but .net, and I'm doing a blog on it, and one of the, and actually the first blog post that I did is about who is liable for the debts. I think that the rush to marriage is going to lead to some very unhappy marriages, because there are certain couples where marriage doesn't make sense. For example, and this is what I talk about in the blog post, if your partner has racked up a huge debt, one of the benefits of staying unmarried is that you're not liable for your partner's debts. And it doesn't make sense just because politically marriage is a good thing, or state-registered domestic partnership or civil union. It doesn't make sense in your situation to do it if what you're doing is taking on debts. And I have had the very unpleasant task very often in the last 3 or 4 years in California of explaining to people that they actually didn't get very many benefits from the marriage. What they got were obligations. So I really want people to be thinking about it, and also be thinking about it in terms of both the public image. We don't want a lot of ugly gay divorces, and also simply the practical side of the cost of ending a legal relationship. Going through a divorce process is not cheap or easy, and if you don't have reasonable confidence that your marriage is going to last, obviously nobody has certain knowledge, but if you don't have reasonable confidence, it's not wise to rush into it.
What are the traditional, what are the roots of our traditional marriage laws and customs? Where do they come from? I mean, ancient Rome is part of it, I guess.
Yeah, no, I love looking at this, because one of the things that even, and of course, the traditional marriage folks keep saying, oh, marriage is unchanged for all these centuries. It's really not quite true. So we have in the United States a blend of Roman law that came through European law. We have, and especially you're in New Mexico, I'm in California, we have a strong influence by Spanish law. That's where community property came from. And we also have English law. We have 3 or 4 different legal traditions that have come about, and they change over time. Just for example, in the simplest of things, which I think is one of the most commonly occurring problems, is what do you have where a couple gets together? One of them has money, maybe from a prior job, maybe from an inheritance. They put in the down. She puts in the down payment. Her girlfriend and she go entitled to the house. 5 years later, they break up. They never did an agreement. What do you do with the $100,000 down payment? Well, in California, for example, up until 15 years ago, unless the couple had an agreement, that down payment became a gift to the family. It became like a dowry, a wedding gift. Well, so many couples were breaking up, and so many couples, their house was their major investment, that about 15 years ago, the legislature changed the law, and now, even without an agreement, the down payment comes back. The amount you spend each month on your spouse, you don't get back, but you get your down payment back. Now, that is a contemporary version of a battle that's been going on for 3,000 years, which is, when you bring an asset or a property into the marriage, do you get it back if the marriage doesn't work out? Most law legal systems say what you acquire during your marriage, you share, absent an agreement. But this whole issue of the dowry or the down payment, do you get it back, has been fought over for thousands of years, and you can still see it playing out now.
To what extent has marriage and have the laws around marriage traditionally favored the husband in heterosexual marriage.
Yes, and of course the question we're going to ask is, what about those lesbian husbands and those gay wives? Well, it used to be in most places in the United States until about, 50 to 75 years ago, so 1930s, 1940s, the husband had great power in the marriage. Basically, only the husband could make money decisions, only the husband could make property decisions. In the 19th century, even assets that the woman inherited were actually controlled by her husband. So the married woman basically was owned by her husband, or employed by her husband, whatever language you want to use, because she really didn't have any autonomy. And starting about 50 to 75 years ago, happening at different stages, different decades in different states, men and women now have equal power, on paper at least, in all of the states in the United States. So that's a perfect example of what would a lesbian couple do if you had a husband-dominated marriage. One of the last bastions, which I also find fascinating, in California up until this year, and I don't know New Mexico law, at a time of a marriage, if a woman was taking her husband's name, that could be done simply by the act of getting married. You didn't have to go through a court name change. And if a woman wanted to keep her own name, that could be done. But if the couple wanted to take different names, or the husband wanted to take the wife's name, last name, you'd have to go to court to do that. And in a same-sex couple, if a lesbian wanted to take her lesbian partner's name, that also had to go through court. And California just last year passed a law allowing you to take your partner's name in a marriage without regarding to gender. But that's a rule that still lingers in most states.
Interesting. As you say in the book, for example, even in, was it Rome, a wife could initiate divorce proceedings against her husband. There have been real waves of women's freedom in terms of marriage and women's oppression in terms of marriage, and some of that oppression came straight from the church.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's another dynamic that is so integrated in our lives we don't even notice it. Despite all the talk about church and state, the United States, every state in this country, allows religious figures to civilly marry people. You've all heard that phrase, by the power vested in me. Well, in Europe, for example, that went out with the French Revolution. If you want to have a legally sanctioned civil marriage, you go to the government office for that marriage, the city hall, the justice of the peace, something like that. If you decide later to have a religious marriage, you go to a church for that. But a priest in France, for example, or even in Italy, which is so theocratic, cannot marry people. And what I like about that arrangement is it reinforces in people's minds that civil marriage is different than religious marriage. Part of the whole gay marriage fight has been this sense that allowing same-sex couples to civilly marry is encroaching on the territory of religion. And I think if we did our civil marriages in a civil room or courthouse or city hall, we would be less likely to be confused between civil marriage and religious marriage.
Well, in that case, civil marriage would become the legal aspect and religious marriage would become the private choice.
Yes, the ceremonial, the spiritual, the private, but it would not have any legal significance. And that is actually the case in most Western European countries.
So what are the differences among marriage, domestic partnership, and civil unions?
Well, first let me just say, when I use the term domestic partnership, I am talking about it in those states where it is marriage equivalent. And so the first thing I have to point out is that one of the biggest problems with domestic partnership is that it's a term that's used so broadly and so loosely that many people are confused. For example, again today I spoke to a client who said, oh, my partner and I are going to register. Well, are they going to register with the city, with the county, with their employer, with the state? Each has different consequences. So in the six states that have what we in the book call marriage equivalents, in those cases, domestic partnership and civil union are identical to marriage under state law, legally speaking, with extremely minor distinctions. So, for example, in California, you can marry even if you don't live together, but to domestically partner, you have to live together. in California, you can get a confidential marriage if you want to keep your marital status secret. You can't get a confidential domestic partnership. So there are a few small differences. But the main difference is that in people's perception of it, it's not acknowledged as marriage. It's not seen as marriage. Mistakes are made by title companies, by lenders, by credit card companies. And so even in those states where it is legally almost identical, on a day-to-day social scene, it's not. And then, of course, there's the whole social stigma problem, which is, if it has all the rights and duties of marriage, why can't I call it marriage? Why can't I call my partner my spouse? That is a kind of insidious discrimination that we were hoping we could eliminate in California, but unfortunately we've not been able to do so.
I mean, it was billed kind of as a perhaps politically viable happy medium, have a marriage equivalent, and but don't call it marriage, but that's not panning out.
Well, it's interesting. I just came across My partner loves to save old magazine articles. I'm less of a hoarder, but he came across this article written in the year 2000 celebrating the transformational victory of civil unions in Vermont. And merely 9 years ago, domestic partnership in California, civil union in France, in Vermont, modeled after the French Pacte Civil, was touted as a dramatic victory. So it's only been in the last 3 or 4 years that the quest for marriage has rendered domestic partnership a second-class status.
I've actually read objections from right-wing critics that domestic partnership would weaken marriage because then straight people would want to sign up for it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we had a big fight here in Oakland when there was city domestic partnership, because the council only opened it to same-sex couples, saying opposite-sex couples have marriage. And there were a lot of straight couples who wanted the, I will call it, more civil, more legalistically oriented domestic partnership. You know, I think that these changes do transform marriage. My insight is that those transformations are not always bad. So, for example, having two women be married does send the message that you don't need a husband and a wife, and that gender roles need not be assigned based on gender identity. Men can cook, women can be the breadwinner, and those changes do actually affect the institution of marriage. And I would say allowing straight couples to domestically partner and not marry does transform the institution of marriage. I happen to think it's a transformation for the good, because what it does is says you can actually shape your arrangement based on what is right for you, not some rigid hierarchy that was set up by someone else.
We're talking to Frederick Hertz, author of the book Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. So the movement against gay marriage, where is that coming from? I mean, Anita Bryant is no longer a viable character on the scene.
You have a good memory. Well, I just read an article actually this morning in the local paper here about the Archbishop of Oakland, who, on behalf of a group of Catholics then in San Diego, which is where he was, really was the first architect and fundraiser for the campaign to take away marriage after the California Supreme Court legalized it a year ago. What's interesting there is that there's been much attention paid to on the Mormon Church, and this was an example of the Catholic Church. I would say it is overwhelmingly religious fundamentalists who have decided to pick marriage as the kind of political litmus test to what kind of society we have. I should point out that the Bible also has prescriptions against killing, and I don't see these same groups at all involved in gun control or anti-crime initiatives, which I wish they would. The Bible also talks about helping the poor, and I don't see those groups. But that's my own editorial comments. It has mostly been religious groups who find that the debate over marriage has become a definitive decision-making point. And one thing that's very interesting, if you look at the battles that's happening in Presbyterian churches and Methodist churches, the issue of ordaining gay priests and doing gay ceremonies has totally divided and created conflict within those churches, even though the number of gay priests is quite small. So it's a kind of parallel issue. It's I would say it is a group looking for an issue and finding it at this place.
And it's been very effective in getting these DOMA, so-called Defensive Marriage Acts, passed in many states.
Oh, yes. More than 30 states have them. These are state laws that make it more difficult for the states to either legalize same-sex marriage or, in some cases, even domestic partnership. Yes, they've been very, very effective. And what's interesting, the article that I read today actually talked about the Catholic Church and the pro-traditional marriage people as being a minority that is embattled. They actually understand that the bulk of society has actually opened up, whether it's interracial, same-sex, single parenting. The percentage of kids raised in traditional two-parent households is less than 50% of all kids. So we are actually part of a larger majority. They are actually a minority that doesn't like losing its privilege.
They don't like losing their privilege, but I think they also see, perhaps correctly, and I say this as a child of divorced parents, that there is something to be said for family stability.
Oh, I talk about this in the book. My parents just celebrated their 65th wedding anniversary. My partner and I just celebrated our 27th year of living together unmarried, and my brother and sister have each been with their spouses more than 35 years. I mean, the joke we have, of course, family gatherings, we've had the same people for dinner now for 30 years. And while there are moments when I would like a little diversity, no, I have benefited greatly from the stability of my family setting. The issue then, though, is that where you have lesbian and gay people who want to participate in that system, I don't understand how excluding gay and lesbian people helps preserve marriage. In fact, the studies, there's a new book that Lee Badgett has done based on the statistics in the Netherlands, which has had marriage for 5 years, is that far more than gay people radicalizing marriage actually moderates gay and lesbian couples. They become more traditional as they get married in terms of financial commitment, family involvement. So in fact, it should, if there was any logic to this, the religious people should be requiring that gay same-sex couples get married. They should be fighting against premarital intercourse. And the gay and lesbian activists should be fighting to be free of marriage. But things haven't turned out that way.
I mean, I think there's a subtext that in a lot of anti-marriage communities, there are people who are essentially closeted and are trying very hard to be heterosexual and not doing very well at it. And some of those are the loudest voices, as we've seen in various public figures.
That's unfortunately that is true. I recently participated in a film called Outrage because a friend of mine was a lover of a prominent closeted politician, and that was a theme throughout that film about what happens when closeted gay politicians want to look like they're on the right side and therefore are more actively anti-gay than the straight ones. I also think, and I say this with all respect for my colleagues in the political realm, I think that the focus on marriage as a civil right has been somewhat of a mistake. It does have civil rights features, but frankly, it is much more about taking on responsibilities. And so I would much rather have seen people fighting to be on the hook for their partner's support, partners fighting to be on the hook for taking care of their children, rather than see it as a give me a benefit, give me a right. because I think actually most heterosexual married people get it, that being married carries a lot of responsibilities. And there's somewhat of a disconnect between the civil rights perspective of marriage as a goody or a benefit and what I think a lot of straight people say, which is, this is not a benefit. This is a burden of responsible society. And if you want in, we should welcome you in, but don't think that it's going to be just a benefit.
So what are some of those responsibilities?
Well, the most important ones are financial. The marrying someone means that you become a single economic unit. It's why the creditors of Mary can go after Susie's earned income. It means that if one Mary needs public assistance, but Susie is a high earner, Mary will be denied public assistance because she has her wife to turn to. It means that if there is a breakup, Mary can be told she has to support Susie rather than putting Susie on welfare. There is a commitment to take care of each other that can be imposed for life. Usually, you know, if there's a breakup and Susie's able to get back to work, Mary doesn't have to support Susie for life. But there really is a very heavy financial responsibility. The other is this notion of being a single economic unit is where the idea of shared benefits and, for example, for a lot of couples, higher income taxes. There was a study done for the state of California that showed that by having marriage rights apply to same-sex couples, the state was going to save millions of dollars a year because, first of all, the tax rates would sometimes be higher, but also one of the partners could no longer seek public assistance if, in fact, she or he could get help from his or her partner. So it's about a kind of financial caretaking, which I will also say has one of the secondary benefits, is which is that you look after your partner in a different way. If I know that I'm going to be supporting my partner if he becomes an alcoholic or stops working, I will take care of him in a different way than if I could say, oh, if he falls off, you know, the high income, high earning wagon, I'm out of here. Well, while you can get divorced, you can still be on the hook for support. And so in that regard, getting married pushes people towards a kind of caretaking that a lot of sociologists and family therapists think is a good thing.
We're talking to Frederick Hertz. The book is called Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. You are a divorce lawyer, so all of these issues, especially where they get thorny, difficult, and emotional, come into your office every day.
True.
And now they're coming in same-sex couples as well as heterosexual couples.
Yes, and mostly now I work as a divorce mediator, where I'm a neutral facilitator rather than an advocate for one or the other. In terms of my own personal career, I have shifted more into mediation than litigation, so I'm still seeing the same problems. I'm seeing them now as a neutral conciliatory figure rather than an advocate, but it's the same issues.
I find it fascinating that you chose not to marry yourself.
Well, it was one of these things where, you know, we thought about it. Obviously I'm educated about it. My partner, who's been listening to my stories for years and was himself married, thought about it. For us, marriage didn't work. And one of the reasons I started becoming more open about my own situation is I wanted people to see how we analyzed it as a model. So, for example, my partner is a retired federal employee. Federal government does not recognize same-sex marriage. If it did, I could get a lot of benefits. I'm paying $540 a month for health insurance, which I could get basically free if we had federal recognition. That's an example of where I can get insurance, but it's costing me $6,000 a year. There are many other benefits I could get if there was federal recognition. But because there isn't federal recognition, I can't get those benefits. At the same time, we've already organized our business and property and financial lives as an unmarried couple, all of which would have to be changed at fairly significant legal and tax costs if we were to marry. And then the third factor, which is that for us, we prefer to be outside of the institution of marriage. marriage. I don't want to have to go through a public divorce. My partner went through a legal divorce. He never wants to do it again. We have a lot of autonomy in our relationship. We keep much of our money separately. We don't, you know, we spend a lot of time together, but we, my partner, for example, lived out of state half time for 10 years. And we actually like the autonomy of being unmarried. We don't like the social notion of being a single family unit. We don't have kids. So for us, being unmarried works better.
After Proposition 8 was passed in California, and I want to talk about that for a moment, I was watching the Colbert Report, and Dan Savage was on it. And
he's great, yeah.
He was hilarious. And he said, you know, the real anti-gay marriage movement is the old demographic, and we're going to outsmart, outlast, and outlive them. And it was, he said it in such a funny way, although it's sort of a harsh thing to say. But are there any young anti-gay, I mean, it seems like that it's kind of a, what's your, is it a kind of a dying movement?
Well, let's say this, no. When, and in fact, I just was listening to a report that Equality California did on, there's a big debate about when to go back to the voters to reinstate marriage, and one of the main arguments for going to 2012 versus 2010 is a certain percentage of the old folks will be dead, and the young people will be hitting voting age, and they estimate that they pick up 2 to 3% per year just by the die-off of the older voters. That being said, among the younger voters, there's still a good 25 to 35% who are against same-sex marriage. So we're not talking about a 0 to 100% shift. We're talking about a 70% hostile in the older crowd to maybe 30% hostile in the younger crowd. So it's not at all a total shift, but it's a pretty dramatic shift in age. All the polling has shown that the numbers are 30, 40% different when you look at the 20 to 30 age grade rank versus the older one. Now, some people have said, well, maybe those young people are going to grow more conservative as they get older. You know, they're just temporarily sympathetic. It doesn't look like that's the case. It really does look like that gay and lesbian life has been integrated into, certainly has been integrated into television shows. You know, these kids grow up with gay families, gay friends. There are gay people coming out in high school. It has just normalized for the next generation in a way they just don't get it, what the opposition is. So there is a strong sense that this is a matter of time unless some dramatic social change happens. And I think that's something to feel hopeful about.
Reading your book, it made it... I was glad. I'm glad that you have a website, because it seems like any time you print the book, it's going to be obsolete 5 minutes later because the laws are changing so quickly.
Well, we had a very funny challenge about that. We knew the California court decision was coming out in June because they had scheduled an oral argument, and in California they always issue their rulings within 90 days. So we actually deliberately held the printing until the court case came out, and as it turned out, Iowa, Vermont, and New Hampshire all happened in that 30-day postponement. So we lucked out. And then what I was so grateful for is in the 45 days between when it went to the printer and came out, there have been no state law changes. So at least it didn't get rendered out of date in that 45 days while it was at the printer.
Right.
But absolutely. In fact, that's the makingitlegal.net. I'm going to have a weekly blog. My co-author, Emily Doskow, has one called Queer Justice, which also has a blog. And then on top of all that, NOLO maintains its own updates, and in fact, there's a reference to it on the cover of the book. I won't tell you what it is, so people have to go buy the book to see it. But there's free access to a website that will have updates, and I watch everything that comes across my desk and on the internet and every source I have, and I just posted a blog 2 days ago about Wisconsin, which has just passed what we're calling Marriage Light. We have marriage, we have marriage equivalent, we have marriage light. The Wisconsin domestic partnership does not include all of the rights and duties of marriage, but many of them. And so, for example, we just put up the Wisconsin news on the website on Thursday last week. Yeah, no, it's hard. It's very hard. It's also, and we try to do this in this book, but for a lot of people, they have very idiosyncratic situations that do require the individual analysis of a lawyer. I would never pretend that we can answer everyone's questions. We hope we give people a framework that when they have questions, they can ask them in a more intelligent way.
So how are other countries grappling with these questions? You've already said that in Western Europe, there's a real separation between civil and religious marriage, and civil is the only one that has any legal bearing. Some European countries have legalized gay marriage.
Yeah, well, there are about five or six that have. Western Europe is far more ahead. Excuse me, getting over coffee here. Far more ahead than we are, and they have legal marriage in five or six countries, and then they have marriage equivalent in an equal number. So they're much further ahead. The one thing that is parallel to here is that the European Union has not mandated recognition of marriage cross country lines. The other thing that makes it a little bit easier in European countries is they don't have separate state laws. Spain has actually some differentiation between provinces, but on the whole, France has one set of marital laws, Italy has one set of marital laws, so you don't have these 50-state battles like we have in the United States. So the other thing to know, which is interesting, and the traditional marriage people have leapt on this, the rate of marriage among heterosexuals is dramatically lower in Europe. My favorite statistic I just read, that if you're the child of an unmarried couple in Sweden, it's more likely you will grow up with your parents living with you than if you were the child of a married couple in the United States. Americans marry, but they also really get divorced. Europeans cohabit without marriage, but they stick together. The average unmarried couple in Sweden stays together longer than the average married couple in the United States, which is something also that we are trying to point out to the traditional marriage people, is that longevity is not guaranteed by marriage.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. Has anyone analyzed why that is, how that works?
Oh, there's a great book by Bruce Cherlin that I just finished. There's some great sociologists of marriage. It's called The Marriage Go Round. And he has a very, very thorough analysis about, his theory is that Americans have both a need for stability and tradition, because they feel disoriented, disrupted, their families have broken up, they've moved, all these things that we all know from our personal experiences are true. So Americans love to have rituals that make them feel rooted, to compensate for their lack of rootedness. And then at the same time, they're incredibly individualistic. If you were to ask 100 couples who got divorced, why did you get divorced, and you took it to Europe and mentioned them, people would be rolling off their chairs laughing. What do you mean you got divorced because of an affair? Every marriage has an affair. What do you mean you got divorced because your wife doesn't respect you? My wife never respected me. You know, they have a notion of marriage that allows complexity, conflict, and infidelity. Whereas Americans tend to think that if the marriage is not perfect, you're going to throw it out and get it. And Americans also remarry at a tremendously fast rate. If it didn't work, instead of people saying maybe the problem is me or my attitudes or the institution, they just think, well, I picked the wrong person. The whole emphasis on the U.S. is about finding Mr. Right, without realizing that it's the whole attitude towards marriage that is wrong, not the person. Person also might be wrong, but it's the wrong marriage model, not the wrong Mr. Right.
Very interesting. It would be interesting to really explore that further. I'll have to look into that more.
Let me just say one of the things that's going to be very interesting is whether same-sex couples will their marriages play out differently. No one knows yet.
Yeah, that's right. Will they fall into this sort of Mr. and Ms. Right set of mythologies?
Yes.
I have a woman friend from college who partnered with a woman who then transitioned to a man. They got married and adopted a child. Now, I know there's not a lot of case law around that, but are there legal issues that come up in cases like that?
Sure, and we actually have a whole section of the book on transgender partners. It's very complicated. Here's the simple rules. in just about every state, if you are legally of the opposite gender, you can marry in a state that doesn't allow same-sex marriage. So if you either were opposite gender when you got married, or one person transitioned and then became legally the opposite gender, then they can marry. So those are the simple ones. The ones that are complicated are the people who have gone through a transition process but have not legally changed their gender. That can happen for two reasons. One is some states have rules of how much surgery do you have to qualify for a legal gender change. And there are people who may have transitioned in terms of their public image and their public identity, but have not had the degree of surgery that their statute requires. There also are some states that don't allow you to change your legal gender. So you can have people that appear to be a same gender couple, but in fact are legally opposite gender, and vice versa. You can have people who appear to be opposite gender, but are really same gender. So those are the people that have problems, because how they appear in the world and how they appear on their name and their even in their driver's license sometimes may not match their legal gender. Those are the ones that have had problems.
Do all states let you change your gender?
Well, physically or legally?
Legally.
No, that's the problem. There are states that do not allow you to change your gender legally, even if you've had full surgical change. So your birth certificate, hence your legal identity, will still be the old way. And so, whereas other states allow you to get a court order that actually results in the issuance of a new birth certificate retroactive, so that it's just like as if you lost your birth certificate, so that if you apply for a passport or a driver's license or Social Security, you can now use your new gender. The problem we have is that there are a lot of people who either are in a state that doesn't allow it or they themselves don't qualify for it, as I said, because they haven't had as much surgery as the law requires, who are actually functioning under the different gender. And those are the people that have a lot of difficult problems. And we have a guest appearance in the book by a lawyer who's very skilled at transgender issues about how to work those things out, either through private agreements or other legal documents, if you fall into that situation.
It also does lead to, I mean, will the judge say, please lift your skirt, ma'am, to prove
whether
you've
had surgery?
Well, it's
funny you say that, because one of the legal issues I dealt with was a couple where they were actually same gender, but one of them presented completely as a woman, had gotten a driver's license as a woman, and they went off to Las Vegas and got married because nobody asked that the skirt be lifted. They got married. They then came back to California, and they were now eligible for a same-gender domestic partnership. And I said to them, it would be better that you had, and one of them had serious health problems, it would be better for you to have a legal same-gender registration than an arguably illegal opposite-gender marriage, right? So they had to actually then end their marriage, and we had to figure out how to end it. We ended up doing it based on an annulment on the grounds of mistake. What was the mistake? Not, oh, I thought she was a man, or I thought she was a woman. No, the mistake was we thought we could be legally married when we couldn't. So we actually put them through a legal annulment, and then they registered as a same-gender couple to correct the mistake they had made by getting married in Las Vegas.
Well, we're just about out of time. In your view, where do you think this whole movement for marriage equality will be in, what, 10 or 15 years?
Oh, I am about as certain as one can be that there will be full legal marriage throughout the United States. One of the things I mentioned earlier is about having these different 50-state rules. We live in a national, federal economy with banks that are national, title companies that are national, and people move at a tremendous high rate. This notion of being married in Massachusetts but not in New Mexico, or being legal parents in California but not in Utah, is just an unworkable system. And so I think in addition to the demographic changes, which we talked about, of younger people being more tolerant, I think that the national industries, frankly, even the credit card and banking industries, will not put up with a system that has people married in one state and not another. So I think we're going to see fully recognized same-gender marriage throughout Western Europe and the United States my prediction is this within 10 years, but I'm very confident in no less than 15 years, hopefully in my lifetime.
Frederick Hertz is the author of the book Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. They're on the web at makingitlegal.net. Thanks, Fred, so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for all your good questions. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime, thanks to the wonderful Dotfoil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.